So welcome everybody to the third session of our Suburbia conference this afternoon. You all know me, Sian Hansen, Executive Director of Legatum Institute. Now we'd like to engage Adam Greenfield in more conversation, a deeper conversation. He is the Urban Fellow. Senior Urban Fellow at LSE Cities, and we certainly welcome your comments. When I asked Adam just now what, you know, general area would he like to talk about, he said actually everything. So with that in mind, I'm going to hand over to you for initial comments.
Lovely.
There'll be a bit of dialogue, I hope, between us, because I've got some things here I'd like to ask you. Super. But then we'll engage everybody once they've had a glass of wine.
Fantastic. I guess I have the privilege of getting to mine first. You'll forgive me, I'm going to do something that I never, ever, ever do, which is essentially to read the prepared comments I've made. Generally, I give talks that are sort of, they're extemporaneous, they're based on, you know, images that I throw up on the screen, and I kind of rip on those images. So deprived of a screen, I'm more or less useless. So I'm just going to kind of read you the thoughts that I've prepared for this. I'd like you to understand that everything I'm about to say is in the nature of an embassy from two places. One is an embassy from Queens in New York City, which is sort of technically and formally urban, but has many of the markers of a suburb, and as I hope to demonstrate, has many of the markers of a suburb of the future. And that's the other place that I'd like to present myself as an ambassador from. In my job, in my line of work, one of my responsibilities is picking up on what we call weak signals and hopefully amplifying those weak signals and trying to see if they can tell us anything about the evolving state of play in time for us to make adaptations to it, useful interventions based on that intelligence. There is an art to this, right? I mean, sometimes what you think is a weak signal may simply be wishful thinking. It may be an artifact. It may be something that is a one-off or not something that will generalize. But I've been doing this for a while, and I'm not terrible at it. So I hope you'll agree with me that the things that I'm picking out of the landscape of Queens are relevant to the discussion we're having today. I start with the notion that we've always tended to regard immigration as a primarily urban phenomenon. From Limehouse to Kreuzberg to the Lower East Side of New York City, City Dispatch were the places where the recently arrived linked up with existing networks made their play for greater power and privilege in a society and sought their first toehold in the new land. But in the United States, at least, every big immigrant group is now majority suburban, according to 2010 to 2013, so recent data provided by demographers of the University of Minnesota. We should be clear that this reflects a class bifurcation. I mean, in the United States, at least, immigrants tend to be overrepresented at both ends of the economic spectrum. I will confess to you that I'm not at all interested in the upper reaches of the socioeconomic scale. Couldn't care less. What I'm interested in is this. What happens to poor immigrants in the suburbs? In the 1980s, it used to be said that the spatialization of wealth in Johannesburg resulted in something called the donut effect, in which a wealthy urban core was surrounded by a sprawl of impoverished communities, many of them literally shantytowns. At the time, this was regarded as exceptional, even as, nota bene, a distinct formal and spatial signature of apartheid itself. As access to city center land gets vertiginously more expensive in conurbations around the world, however, this donut shape is increasingly the norm. What happens out of the donut? Well, transit connectivity, we know, is not great. It's probably better here, in fact, than it is in most cities in the world. I mean, we have an astonishing public transit system here, and we should be grateful for it each and every single day. But even so, out on the periphery, given the hub-and-spoke nature of the network topology, it's still not great in getting from any place except into central London. Access to goods and services is not great. Simply taking care of the daily logistics of household maintenance is a vastly more complicated enterprise and a vastly more time-demanding enterprise than it is for most of us city dwellers. The suburbs, technically, are low-density, as we've discussed at great length, but they're also brittle and overspecified. They were designed for a way of life that's clearly on its way out, a way of life that's passing into history. The suburbs were designed for different populations with different capabilities, different tools at their disposal, and different needs than the people who currently call them home. And they're not particularly adaptable to change. The traditional American suburban cul-de-sac development is a perfect example of this. New developments are still, in 2014, greenfield sites are often planted with single-family detached houses at a density of about 1 to 6 units to the acre, on the theory that generous lots enhance resale value. Now, this economic argument is probably sound, but it's probably not tenable moving forward. The social economic logic of these developments is predicated not merely on access to vehicular mobility, but in fact on multi-car families, where the ratio of owned cars to adults very nearly approaches 1 to 1. It's hard for me to imagine, with the world under the environmental pressure it is, with the car itself under technical pressure, and with our societies under energetic pressure of every kind, that this is a sustainable way of doing things. Of course, human ingenuity under pressure is legendary. People have ways of tailoring an environment that's programmed for low density to the exigencies of real life and their own needs. Outer Queens may be the example here. Now, if you're familiar with New York City, you know that New York City is partitioned into 5 boroughs, Manhattan being the core, most heavily urbanized and densest, Brooklyn close behind it. When you go out towards Jamaica, out towards the airport, out towards Lower Queens, you get a housing condition that's much more similar to the sorts of suburbs that you see here. Single-family detached structures of relatively recent vintage. None of them are of great quality. None of them were particularly designed with any flair. None of them were designed to be environmentally or economically sound. They were designed for single working-class families. That's no longer who they tend to be home to. What we see is informal housing provision in what amount to extra-legal hostels, shared houses that pack 8 or 10 people to a floor, even at higher densities than that. We've even begun to see houses that have what we might regard as hot swappable partitions, plywood partitions that have been force-fit into rooms that were designed for families to enable them to function as single-room occupancy hostels for essentially transient workers. We, of course, see patterns of informal mobility provisioning. At the edges of the formal public transit network, we see what we call the dollar van, which is something that most New Yorkers don't even know exists, or at least most of the middle-class people who call Manhattan home and work in the towers of downtown. They're not even aware of this extraordinarily supple, ingenious, arguably more efficient way of provisioning mobility that exists at the periphery of the network topology that they're familiar with. The dollar van, with its variable routes and to a degree negotiable fares, points in the direction that I think we're all going to be moved in when fused to the technology of the smartphone. And
can I just ask, dollar van for yeah. us Londoners is?
A dollar van is a 6 to 8, maybe 12 person maximum vehicle. They tend to loiter around the parking lots at the end of the transit lines. They pick up people who flag them down. They're extra legal. They're not licensed. They're not regulated, like the name implies. So where New York City transit fares may run you about $2.50 for a ride on the subway or on a bus, dollar van, around a dollar, basically negotiable to wherever you need to go. So depending on how far out into the suburbs you live, you may have a driver showing reticence. But, the Colombian community, the Nigerian community, immigrant communities of a variety have imported this model from their own home terrain, if you will, into New York City and made it work. Recently, we've begun to see attempts at digitally mapping the dollar van network. And it's kind of like if you look at the lungs and you see the brachial tubes. Those are the sorts of the trunks of the existing public transit network, the capillaries. Are the dollar vans. They insufflate the immigrant neighborhoods around the ends of the lines with access to mobility. They couple to the formal public transit network, but they're, like as I say, so far entirely unregulated and almost invisible. We also see networks of informal service provision. As I said, we've seen informal housing. We see an economy and a way of life largely invisible to the state, to formal economic actors, and to those of us who are already well assimilated into the economy. Now, this way of doing things has certain market advantages that make it extraordinarily attractive as a way of life for the future. For those of us who are able to take off the blinders of our own personal preferences and our comfort zone, My colleague at LSE City, Susie Hall, has done some remarkable works on the high streets of London. Her program is called Ordinary Streets. And what she's shown is the immense economic and social generative power of densely pluri-utilized sites on high streets around London. Immigrants will take over a retail space that may have been intended for one business, and they'll subdivide it into a space where seven businesses coexist with one another. They share the same physical space. They negotiate that use over the day. They negotiate clientele with one another. People are living cheek by jowl, but they're also generating a remarkable amount of revenue, and there's an incredible amount of very densified economic activity that goes on in these places. As a matter of fact, Susie has an incredible slide which has changed the way that I think of economic development in cities. She shows an expanse of roughly similar area between, I believe it's on the Walworth Road, so store frontage on the Walworth Road, and a similar amount of retail area in Stratford, where so much effort and activity has been focused on the new economy. And what she shows is that the immigrant storefront supports more jobs that generate higher revenue per person, and in both absolute and relative terms, more economic activity than the formal economic alternative. We're not investing in these places. We barely know they exist. Most of us have never been in such places. I would argue that this pattern presents an opportunity for us. It presents the notion of the suburb as platform for radical experimentation in spatial provisioning and in service provisioning. I think this way of using space, of densifying the environment, of forcing the environment to do multiple things at once, generating multiple kinds of value in multiple registers, is the only key to a sustainable future. It's not about macro engineering experiments or, you know, smart grids or green architecture. It's about taking existing places and manifesting the latent value that resides in them through extraordinarily intensive resource utilization and exploitation in ways that Western culture has heretofore not been particularly comfortable with. When you fuse this to the ability of the technologies that are now coming online to tell us things about the use of urban space, to indicate real-time patterns of demand, and to connect people with something to offer with people who want to make use of those services, facilities, and resources, I think we actually have a reasonable recipe for a survivable future. I would argue to you that it's, in fact, the only recipe for a survivable future. My personal belief is I don't think we're going to make it any other way. So the conversation so far today has been a little bit frustrating for me, frankly, because of all of the sorts of unquestioned verities that we've uttered about the nature of the spaces that we live in, the nature of the means through which we employ the resources that have been invested in those spaces, the ways in which we personally cobble together a way of living. I think that we're all going to have to get used to a very much different way of realizing the value in our environment. I'm personally rather looking forward to that. I have found that on the rare occasions in my life that I've been able to live in that way, putting aside my privilege, putting aside my identity and my ego, living in that way, I found it extraordinarily fulfilling, among the most fulfilling hours of my life. I cannot promise that everybody would have the same experience of things as this. And I do not mean to fetishize the developing world. I do not mean to fetishize the favela or anything like it. But I think that we're all going to taste a little bit more of what that looks like in our lives, and I think it will be very, very good for us indeed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If I might take my privilege and ask the first question, I'd quite like to pull out a couple of threads that you have put forward. Talk about immigration, migrants. You talk about sustainability. I have a big problem with the word sustainability.
Yes, we do.
Because I'm not sure everybody has the same idea of what it is. You spoke about value. All of these things, and I'm just going to throw this out here, and it's counterintuitive, but all of these things speak to, and then you mentioned slums. And I have a suspicion and I can't prove it, that we have quite a lot to learn from the connectivity and, if you like, the social prosperity, to use Ed's word, of slum dwelling, particularly migrant slum dwellings, in what you're saying is our future.
Yeah, you know, there's an architect based out of Mumbai named Rupali Gupta, and she uses this amazing terminology that I've latched onto. She calls the quality that we're looking for transactive capacity. And when you look at the physical ways in which slum dwellings tend to be open to the environment, the porosity and the edge condition up against the street and the scale of things, the scale of the flows that are moving past, what she argues for is that most informal, unplanned communities around the world, certainly not in the developed north, but in the global south, have an astonishing transactive capacity in the everyday environment, that they tend to underwrite more frequent and more value-generating interactions between people. Similarly, the medieval street fabric of a place like the City of London does this. When we allow our places to do that, they're capable of functioning in that way. What we need to do is not overplan, overwrite, overdevelop them so that they lose that transactive capacity. We've heard the word intimacy used. I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. I think that even our mobility systems could be designed in this way. I recall something that I saw in Barcelona once, which was a woman riding her small wheel-based bicycle down a very narrow street past a shop front which opened directly onto the street. And she happened to notice that her friend was working in the shop. The scale of her bicycle, the speed that she was able to get up to in the street, allowed her to slow very elegantly to a stop, immediately strike up an impromptu conversation with her friend, you know, for 2 or 3 minutes' time, and then start up and keep riding and move back into the flow of things once she concluded the conversation. We need, if we are going to be making design interventions into the environment, to learn those lessons of places that work. Mm-hmm. But again, this is nothing new. This goes back to Bernard Rudofsky in the 1950s and 1960s. This goes back to Architecture Without Architects. This goes back to his other book, Streets for People. There are sorts of known techniques, known ways of doing this, some of which got folded into and co-opted by the new urbanist movement, other techniques which haven't, and I think have a lot more to do with the slums and the informal urban developments that you're talking about than most contemporary urban and suburban development in the developed north.
So it's not as counterintuitive as I thought.
No,
actually, I don't know if we have any artists with us, but I just recently went to, and this is happening all over London, I just went to a play that was set in a nail bar, and the play was in a nail bar on Camden High Street. So there were 20 seats in the nail bar where we sat, and then there was 5 performances, and then it disappeared again. There's guerrilla retail. There's a pop-up restaurants. So we are using spaces in quite a fluid way now in London. I think people are learning that. So can we open this conversation up to the floor, and yes, the high streets.
No, it's not much bad. Thank you, it's very interesting. So I just want to just sort of press a little bit in a way. On one hand, you say the suburb is sort of, you know, it's become historical. I think you're talking about a particular sort of suburb, because obviously you'd acknowledge that in a way suburbs are all a part of the layers of the city. But it isn't actually this informality that interests you, fundamentally suburban, because in many ways the ideal city, the utopian city, that's the very ordered environment, that's the idea of plan, the idea of top-down. It's in many ways an urban idea, and it's the places built on the edge of the city walls, I'm thinking south of the river here maybe, you know, which are actually, that it's those suburbs which actually articulate that informality that you're interested in.
I tend to think that informality cuts against the urban and suburban distinction more than it aligns with it. I think that you can find very highly planned suburbs like Levittown, you can find, you know, informal developments like those that surround Brasilia. Similarly, you can find very, very highly ordered urban developments and very, very highly anarchic and bottom-up urban developments. So it is the formality that I'm interested in. But at the same time, I want to emphasize that it's not all, you know, all rules are thrown out the window. We tried non-plan. right? Non-plan, you know, a la Bannum didn't work. Non-plan got us sprawl. Non-plan, you know, there's this great feminist argument from the 70s called the tyranny of structurelessness. And the argument of the tyranny of structurelessness is that in a structureless environment, the people with the existing power are able to press their claims much more efficiently than others. That was what non-plan was. Non-plan was an unstructured environment that was very rapidly exploited by commercial real estate development for its own ends. So
still another form of
planning.
Yeah.
Sure, it's privatized.
Yeah.
And it was exploited by a formally ruleless, formally unplanned urban provisioning on the part of the community, the commonwealth. So I do think that we need some guidelines in place, but I tend to think that I buy the orthodoxy that people left to their own devices make better decisions about spaces. They're more adaptable decisions. They're more congenial decisions. But I think that they have to make those decisions in a context that recognizes the extraordinary pressure we're under now. I mean, we are in a new regime. In the next several years, and probably not even several, think about this. 75% of Bangladesh will be underwater. Where are those people going to go to, right? And where are the people that those people displaced going to go to? We're all of us going to get used to living cheek by jowl. And so I think, with all due respect to those who advance this argument, it's a little bit fatuous to talk about unlimited choice. Yeah, of course people may want a garage and a car. They may want that. They may not be able to have that. I'm not talking about centralized planning, and I'm not talking about, you know, a sort of fascist imposition of ecological soundness. But I think that we will learn very rapidly that there are certain things that are just off the agenda.
So you seem to be discounting the futurists who are saying nanotechnology will take care of these resource constraints and we can have everything we want.
Does anybody actually believe that?
I don't know. Does anybody actually believe that?
This is the double garage.
Yeah, this is the double garage.
Isn't it a bad change? I mean, taking a carrots and sticks earlier, haven't we got to present this in a way that's attractive? I mean, the environmental problem has been, it's always negative. And actually, if you can present a vision of the future that people want, it's about desire.
Yeah.
And reconciling nature and culture.
Yes.
In the 21st century.
I think you put it beautifully. I think it is about the design of an incentive landscape that results in policies and practices that are more likely to allow us to survive than otherwise.